Tom Hall. This is Midday. It's Midday Culture Connections with Dr. Sherry Parks. Today, what makes the Twittersphere go boom? Kanye West's bromance with Donald Trump, Joy Reid's walk back of homophobic blog posts, and Michelle Wolf's White House correspondent's dinner routine, which was met with rebuke, finger-wagging, and snowflaking on an epic scale. How do we navigate self-expression in the age of social media, armchair prosecutors, and trial by tweet? Dr. Sherry Parks and Dr. Stanford Carpenter weigh in. Plus, Mekhi Johnson, a senior at the Gilman School in Baltimore, was accepted into all 8 Ivy League schools. He's spent the last few weeks trying to decide which one he'll attend in the fall. Today's the deadline for that decision, and he'll announce it when Midday starts right after the news. Good afternoon and welcome. It's Midday. As a matter of fact, it's Midday Culture Connections with Dr. Sherry Parks. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us. Today we're going to examine the many firestorms that have erupted over the past week surrounding a rapper, a comedian, and, you know, a journalist for MSNBC. They set the Twittersphere alight with a series of pro-Trump tweets. That's what Kanye West did. That led to more than a few people question not only Kanye's mental health, but they even led to people challenging his blackness. Comedian Michelle Wolf has come under fire for her biting roast at the White House Correspondents' Dinner Saturday night. Her comments about White House spokesperson Sarah Huckabee Sanders drew the ire of many journalists who often fault Ms. Sanders for her work behind the podium in the White House briefing room. And MSNBC host Joy Reid's journalistic ethics have been called into question as excerpts that are being called homophobic surfaced from a blog allegedly authored by the popular weekend news host in the mid to late 2000s. Dr. Sherry Parks has been in the Department of American Studies at the University of Maryland College Park for more than 30 years, and next month she'll be joining the Maryland Institute College of Art as Vice President of Strategic Initiative. She joins us every month for the Midday Culture Connections. Good to see you, Sherry.
Hi there.
And joining Sherry and me here in Studio A is Dr. Stanford Carpenter. He's a cultural anthropologist, a comic book creator, and a political consultant. He serves on the board of the Black Comic Arts Festival, and his work can be found in the recently published Black Comics Returns and the Encyclopedia of Black Comics. It's good to see you. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you very much.
Last time you were on the show, you were on the phone from Chicago, and I'm delighted that we can meet in person. So welcome. You are welcome, listeners, to join our conversation, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org, and our Twitter handle, @midday_WIPR. And in just a minute or two, we are going to be streaming on the WIPR Facebook page. So before we start talking about Kanye and Michelle Wolf and Joy Reid, I want to welcome to the program Mekhi Johnson. He's a senior at the Gilman School in Baltimore, and like many young men and women his age, he has endured the vagaries of the college admission process over the last several months. But unlike most of his peers, his challenge was unique. All 8 Ivy League schools accepted Mekhi into their freshman class next fall. And Mekhi has had to choose which one he's going to attend. Well, today is the deadline for that decision, and Mekhi has slipped out of class, something he's evidently not very accustomed to doing, to join us and announce his choice. Mekhi, welcome to Midday.
Hi, thank you.
Thank you for being with us. So just to have folks put this in context, you're a senior at Gilman, and all 8 Ivy League schools accepted you. Obviously, you applied there. Did you apply to other schools as well?
So I did. I applied to a few other schools. I applied to Georgetown, UVA, University of Michigan, UMD, and I think that's it.
Uh-huh. Did any of them turn you down?
No, actually.
There you go. So let's get to it. Where have you decided to attend school in September?
So after a very long visiting process and much soul searching, I've decided to enroll at Harvard University.
Harvard University. So you're headed to Cambridge, Massachusetts.
Yeah.
Obviously, you had an awful lot of choices here. Can you pinpoint what the particular appeal of Harvard was, or how you came to that decision?
I think when I really came down to it, obviously I visited most of the schools, and so when I got to Harvard, honestly, there was just an energy, a feeling there that attracted me that wasn't necessarily the same somewhere else. So aside from, obviously, academic offerings opportunities. It really just came down to that gut feeling.
And do you have an idea of what you want to study?
So I'd like to go to law school. I think I'll either major in political science or linguistics, possibly with a minor in classics or Spanish.
And is this a huge weight off of your shoulders?
Absolutely. The decision has taken a very long time, and I'm feeling very relieved right now.
Was there a really close second runner-up, or was it, you know, at the end of the day, you knew in your heart that Harvard was the slam dunk choice?
So I was really between Harvard and the University of Chicago, and at the end of the day, I came to this decision, but it was very close.
And do you have to inform the other seven Ivy League schools that you've decided to take a pass?
So I do. I have to decline admission, sign into the portals of all of them and do that.
Have you notified Harvard that you're going to take them up on their offer?
I have not quite yet.
So you're telling us before you're telling Harvard, huh? Have you told your friends?
Yes, I have.
And are they giving you high fives and attaboys, or are they saying, oh, dude, you should have gone to Chicago?
They're all super excited for me.
Well, we are super excited for you as well. I really appreciate your taking the time to let us know. It's an incredible achievement to have had such a great academic career through your high school years that all eight Ivy League schools acknowledge the kind of student you are and acknowledge that they would have been pleased to have you. So congratulations to Harvard. What class have we pulled you out of for being on the show today?
Chemistry.
All right. Well, we don't want you to fail chemistry because that would be a bad thing, showing up to Harvard with an F in chemistry. So get back to class. And thank you very much. And congratulations. It's a really impressive and incredible achievement. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
All right. Makai Johnson, he is headed to Harvard University in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Sherry Parks, is pretty exciting, isn't it?
Yeah, what I want to say is that there is research. The way he made that decision with his gut is actually how incoming freshmen make their decisions about where they go, where they feel comfortable. So, I mean, he's obviously brilliant, but the fact that he made that decision with a gut is supported by the research.
Yeah.
And he evidently started this plan when he was little.
Yeah, that's what I've heard. Yeah. So he, you know, he had his eye on the prize. He had a goal in mind, and he kept it. Speaking of Harvard University, Joy Reid is a graduate of Harvard University. She has a documentary film degree from Harvard.
Nice segue.
Yeah, and she's in a heap of trouble. I mean, there's all sorts of stuff going on. So Sherry, get us up to speed on Ms. Reid's current problems.
Well, her problems may not have started as her own, but there were some homophobic statements that showed up that are attributed to her. And she's evidently spent a great deal of effort and money trying to find out whether her site was hacked or not, and hasn't been able to prove that. And so now she's apologized for it's a very interesting loop. She's apologizing for something that she says she didn't do, because the buck stops at her own site, and we know that. And so there's this is made much more complicated by technology and the fact that many celebrities don't write their own social media. But she suggests that it was somebody who was trying to troll her, to hack her, and make her look that way. Mm-hmm. And that's pretty easy to do, actually.
Yeah. So Stanford Carpenter, there are some comments in a blog post that she had long time ago called the Reid Report, and she is suggesting that it's possible somebody has hacked into that account and added these comments to stuff that she had written and that she was not, in fact, the author of that. Are people taking that claim seriously?
Well, people are taking the claim seriously, but the more I read the articles, the more I started looking into this whole issue of hacking and the archive, what struck me is that the internet is a public space, right? But it's a public space in which it is archived. So you've got all of these, so you can always go back and look at what someone has said, right? And at some point, I started to wonder if it really matters whether she was hacked, because at a certain point, there are a few things that she's admitted to saying that were problematic, and somebody still could have hacked her and added more to it, but we're really stuck in this morass of, like, what do you do when you have a public space where everything's archived and you also have concerns that someone can go in and change the archive?
Yeah, and in December of last year, so what, 6 months ago, 5 months ago, she apologized, Ms. Reed apologized to Charlie Crist, who was the governor of Florida at a time that Joy Reid was writing about him on her blog. She nicknamed him Miss Charlie and claimed that he only married a woman for political purposes, that he was a closeted gay man, and she made fun of him. And she owned that and admitted to it, apologized to Mr. Crist, who's now a member of Congress. Mr. Crist accepted her apology and says, you know, it's all in the past. But that's a real one. That wasn't a hack. We're sure about that because Ms. Reed has acknowledged that. But then that, you know, so that clouds everybody's understanding of whether or not these additional comments, which are homophobic, would be, with the credibility of this hacking theory.
Well, it's interesting because we're in this very interesting moment where the public and the private blur. I mean, journalists say all kinds of things behind the scenes that are, you know, and we're going to talk about, you know, Michelle Wolf probably in a bit, where people and comedians and other people say things. But as Stanford said, I mean, one is it's archived, and two, what one says in what used to be a clearly defined public versus private space isn't anymore. And people can find out all kinds of things. And so if indeed he had married a woman as a front, that would be a legitimate news story now. It wouldn't have been a legitimate news story 15 years ago. There's no evidence that she did the journalism work to prove that. But we're in this muddy space where the First Amendment does not protect you from the consequences of your utterances. It never has, but now we know them. And so we're in this very muddy space that the forefathers could not have foreseen.
Yeah. Yeah. And Stanford Carpenter, Joy Reid acknowledged the skepticism that people have on her show last Saturday, which I was not able to see. But she says, or she said on the show, when a friend found the posts in December and sent them to me, I was stunned. Frankly, I couldn't imagine where they'd come from or whose voice that was. And in the ensuing months, I've spent a lot of time trying to make sense of these posts, and I've hired cybersecurity experts to see if somebody had manipulated my words on the former blog, and the reality is that they've not been able to prove it. So she is, you know, acknowledging people's skepticism here and apologizing. Isn't that enough? When you apologize, isn't that over?
I think, in a perfect world, it should be, but this is not a perfect world. I mean, this is about journalism, but this is also about politics. This is about, you know, we're in a very polarized moment where people are taking shots at the people who they disagree with. So you can't look at it outside of that, right? There's, you know, we tend to take shots at the people we disagree with, not the people who we agree with most of the time. It's not like I don't get the sense that it is her fans and the people who advocated for her that are pushing this. They're reacting. So it's a difficult moment.
Yeah.
Well, and you asked if sorry was enough. There's a media ritual that has now been taken to an extreme of the public flogging, where someone would do something, they would say they're sorry, but it's not over yet because, I mean, you have to be publicly flogged before you are redeemed, because redemption is the end. It's not just innocence. And now the public flogging has become highly partisan. And so people start the flogging almost immediately as a way of punishing people and punishing their enemies, and to take the conversation away from the issues, or even the issue of homophobia as a cultural phenomenon. That's not what this is about. This is about the public flogging.
Because the apology thing, what if Donald Trump were to say, you know, I really apologize. I shouldn't have said what I said after the murder in Charlottesville and the riot in Charlottesville. I shouldn't have said what I said about Mexican immigrants. I shouldn't have said what I've said about Muslims. What would we do with that? I mean, he did make up about a 30-second apology about the birther, assertions that he'd made for years and years and years. And after giving a 4-minute commercial for his hotel property, he said, oh, by the way, Obama was born in America. He was
But that's not
Hawaii.
An apology.
Yeah, but yeah. I'm not even sure he uttered the words, I'm sorry. He did utter the words, I'm sorry, I think, for his locker room talk after the Access Hollywood thing came up. But, you know, it is an interesting moment, isn't it,
with I think
apologizing.
I don't know if it really is about the apology. I think that when I think about it in terms of having an archived space, right, you know, once you reach this level, you know, this level of a space where you can't distance yourself from something that you said 15 years ago, something that you said 20 years ago. I'm sure that everybody in this room has probably had something that they said 15, 20 years ago that they probably wouldn't want the rest of the world to hear. I'm sure that all the listeners probably have something like that, right? And the question becomes, how do you distinguish that between somebody who said it 15 years ago, said it 10 years ago, said it 5 years ago, 5 months, yesterday, right? And is continuing to say that. So there's a qualitative, there's still a qualitative difference that we're not making here in terms of not just the statements, but the actions that are connected to it. And I think that what's going to have to happen is there's going to have to be some sort of reevaluation as to how we take quotes, how we take what people said in the past and reconciling that with their actions.
So you're calling for a statute of limitations on
quotes? Yeah.
Wait a minute. Because I think what's interesting is, I'm sorry, that was a cheap shot. Stanford and I
you apologize.
I apologize. Stanford and I have known each other for a long time, so we're on that basis. But often you will hear when something surfaces, if it's old, they'll say, oh, that was 20 years ago, without saying, and that person has changed. The assumption is that they have changed.
Right.
And that, so I think it works both ways. I actually agree with you that time is a factor, but it is not an absolute factor the way some people have tried to use it.
I agree, too. I think, and that's why I was saying reconciling it with actions, right? So it's not just about saying, oh, it happened 15 years ago, I've changed. I think there is a responsibility for someone to demonstrate that they said it 15 years ago and they've changed. Why not using the archive to say, look, there's a consistent change in terms of my positions on this. I have come around. I am not the person that I was 15 years ago. I'd hope you would recognize that. I think that is a very different position than that, you know, when you bring up the example of comparing Joy Reid to Donald Trump.
And the best part is if they have some sort of epiphany or transformation process to point to.
Exactly.
Dr. Stanford Carpenter is a cultural anthropologist, a comic book creator, and a political consultant. Dr. Sherry Parks is about to become the vice president for strategic initiatives at the Maryland Institute College of Art. She's the author of Fierce Angels, Living with a Legacy from the Sacred Dark Feminine to the Strong Black Woman. We're taking your calls. We're reading your tweets and your emails when we come back from a quick break. 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. To find us on Twitter, @midday WIPR. And you can also check out what's happening here in Studio A on the WIPR Facebook page. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us. Welcome back. It's Midday Culture Connections with Dr. Sherry Parks. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow, it's Midday at the Movies, the Film Festival edition. The 20th annual Maryland Film Festival kicks off tomorrow night, and we'll have a preview with founding director Jed Dietz, festival contributors and filmmakers Matt Porterfield and Joe Tropea. The actor Jim Belushi is going to call in. Cinematographer Bradford Young is going to talk to us, as well as director Eric Young. So lots of folks talking about the 20th annual Maryland Film Festival, which opens with their shorts program tomorrow night. We'll talk about it tomorrow on Midday. If you are just joining us today, as I mentioned, it is the Midday Culture Connections with Dr. Sherry Parks. Sherry is the author of Fierce Angels, Living with a Legacy from the Sacred Dark Feminine to the Strong Black Woman. We're joined here in Studio A by cultural anthropologist and political consultant Dr. Stanford Carpenter. You are welcome to join us as well. Our phone number on Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. Our Twitter handle, @midday WIPR. And we are streaming on the WIPR Facebook page. So, Sherry, Michelle Wolf, did you see her her bit? Did you see the YouTube clip or watch it live? And
what did you think? I did not watch it live. I saw it after the moment. I mean, the White House Correspondents' Dinner is something I try to watch anyway, but I definitely had to watch this one after the immediate uproar.
Yeah, what did you think? First of all, what did you think of her performance?
I thought she said lots of things that were provocative and many of which needed to be said. And I think she used humor adroitly. I mean, she's very experienced. I think she said things that, had she not been a woman, might not have been quite so controversial.
So why?
Why? You know, because, and she has said this, so I shouldn't suggest that this is original to me. That means she is in... Well, first of all, she has a very public track record of a type of humor, and they hired that. But I think the people who said she was using filthy words, I had to go back and see, okay, and she was using words that are now in the public domain, and certainly things that one hears on the comic circuit all the time. Not that I speak that way. I'll be honest, I don't speak that way. But she simply did the humor the way she does it to say some very strong things. And I think the filthy part is an excuse for the strength to explain away their response to the strength of what she said, because she skewered pretty much everybody.
Yeah. Did you think it was funny?
There were some moments, yes, that I did laugh.
Yeah, I thought it was funny too. And I thought Stanford Carpenter, that there were some moments that completely bombed. I mean, like any set, any comedic set. But it's interesting because the criticism from the right often has been about the filth and the use of her language. But she got a lot of criticism from the left as well. Mika Brzezinski tweeted like in real time or the following morning that as a person who'd been criticized for her appearance by President Trump, she felt that the White House Correspondents Association owes Sarah Huckabee Sanders an apology for the comments that Michelle Wolf made about her. What's your take?
Well, I'm not sure how I feel about calling on the organization to issue an apology for a comedian. That seems incredibly complicated response given the circumstances. I also look at the White House Correspondents' Dinner as a study in masochism. You literally got a group of people who put on a dinner, and they hire a comedian. And they hire a comedian that they know is going to have some very biting things to say, and they know that
as have many comedians before her,
right? Yes. Yeah. But they also know that they are going to be the subject of the jokes, and they still show up, right? It's kind of like, they still show up, they laugh, and then afterwards we go through this ritual, and it's been like this for the past couple of years.
Yeah. Did she cross the line?
Did he or she cross the line? Oh, I'm offended that person made a joke about me, and I'm thinking, well, why did you show up in the first place?
I'm really glad that you started with the humor analysis, because I hope we would get to that. Because what we've had the last couple of years is an imbalance. The White House Correspondents' Dinner is based on it's a roast, it's a balance, where the person who comes out and skewers the press is the president, and then the press comes out and skewers him. So with Trump being absent, which he has been, which in a PR moment is actually smart because he draws the attention away from the White House dinner and towards something else. Here, she's carrying both loads. So she's skewering the president and skewering the media, and there's not the back and forth, which makes it seem fair.
Yeah, David Axelrod tweeted, oh boy, did you hear the offensive and horrible things that were going on Saturday night, meaning Trump's rally in Michigan. and then there was the White House Correspondents' Dinner. Here's Dave Chappelle appearing on PBS talking about his colleague in the comedic universe, Michelle Wolf.
I really respected what I saw. I don't know who those people think they are that she can't say that to them. They offend people all the time. And I think that for many people, not everybody who watched that, but for many people, it's cathartic to watch that woman speak truth to power like that. And whether they understand it or not, there was an enormous amount of levity in what she did. But it was very flat-footed, and it was grounded in her truth. And whether I agree with it or not, I gotta respect the artistry. I gotta respect the gangster. I know how hard it is to do what she did in front of that lame crowd. And I think she nailed it. I thought it was beautiful. And I didn't see her pander once. And I thought that was beautiful.
She certainly didn't pander, Dave Chappelle. And I think he's got a point about the lame crowd. I mean, that's a tough room when there are people on the right sort of preordained to not respond to jokes that are dismissive or, you know, satirizing their political persuasion.
I agree. And I also feel like, you know, again, you know, we need to talk about the moment we're in. We're in a moment where has she said anything more offensive than what the president has said publicly? Has she, you know, and he can't say, oh, I'm a comedian, right? We don't elect, well, we can't elect a comedian to be president, but we don't expect the president to be a comedian. I think that there's this merger of people trying to use this as an example of, you see, look at where the level of debate has gone. I can't believe that people are saying these types of things. But Sherry, you're right. I mean, in comedy, that's what comedians do.
And it's a hard space to say that it's not okay for the president, but there's not an uproar every time he does anything anymore. There's a coarsening of the public sphere, but it's not okay for her to do it, someone who positions themselves on the other part of the public sphere. Now, we also have to remember that this is televised now. It hasn't always been. So the public arena is a factor here, that people, we are watching people who have a public persona being skewered.
There's two things about it that strike me as interesting. The first is whether or not what she said, for example, about Ms. Sanders was offensive. I don't hear it as offensive.
I didn't
Mika Brzezinski did hear it as offensive, but I did not. She talks about how Sarah Sanders, and you know, if you didn't hear the joke, it's hard to sort of explain. We don't have a clip of it, but she talked about how Sarah Sanders burns facts and then uses them basically as eye makeup. Right. And this was interpreted as a slam on Sarah Sanders' appearance. Did you hear it as that?
I didn't hear it as an insult. But I think what's behind that is that Sarah Sanders does not look like most of the people that we see in front of the media. And so that kind of implicit bias is hanging there. And so what she actually said was not insulting. She actually said she, you know, she has ashes after she burns these, you know, these facts that she lies. And then she uses the ash to make a perfect smoky eye, which is something that some women spend a lot of time learning how to do.
And smoky eye is like a shade of makeup or something? What is that?
Yes, it's when you take black and gray or other colors and shade in your eye. I can give you the history of the smoking eye, but there's a whole nother show about why women use certain types of makeup in certain parts of their faces. It's tied to sex, but it's the short end of it. But what she said didn't, but bringing up her looks at all, I think, is what people are responding to, that she says something at all about her looks, but there was no insult.
So listeners, if you heard Michelle Wolf at the White House Correspondents' Dinner, if you want to weigh in on Joy Reid or Kanye West, we may get to him in a little bit. Give us a call at 410-662-8780, our email midday@wipr.org, on Twitter @MiddayWIPR. I'm on Twitter @TomHallWIPR, and we are streaming on the WIPR Facebook page. And Stanford Carpenter, former Arkansas Governor, Governor Huckabee, which is pretty... Mike Huckabee tweeted what may be the lowest hanging fruit on the tree of irony that I've ever read. He says the White House Correspondents' Dinner was supposed to celebrate the First Amendment. Instead, they celebrated bullying, vulgarity, and hate, as if bullying and vulgarity and hate was invented by Michelle Wolf Saturday night.
Well, to some degree, the First Amendment was designed to protect that. It was designed to protect exactly that kind of language. I just keep looking at this whole thing. I'm just like wow. You know, I think, for instance, one of the things I find interesting about Sarah Huckabee Sanders is that when she gets up and speaks, she makes some of the most biting comments, and she does them so well. I actually think that the idea of us talking about her being on the receiving end of some really biting jokes, given what she's put people on the receiving end. It's a really interesting contrast all around. And I don't mean that in terms of saying that Sarah Huckabee Sanders deserves to be treated poorly, but these are all people who give as good as they take.
I mean, Barack Obama was an excellent comedian, as it turns out.
Yes.
I mean, the night that he was, you know, killing Osama bin Laden, he went into the room and, as we say in the comedy business, killed, you know, ironically.
Put on pump.
Yeah. But he also allowed himself a chuckle or two when people made jokes at his expense. I watched the C-SPAN feed of this. I didn't watch the CNN feed after the fact, and they cut to Ms. Sanders a couple of times, who was stone-faced and clearly upset and uncomfortable. But I wonder if, because again, people are just so used to taking their political corners these days and never getting out of them, whether she had no choice but to not, you know, join in on the fun in a self-deprecating way.
Well, to extend what Stanford said about people show up, why do you sit on the dais when you know what's going to happen? I mean, then they point to you and say things about you. So Seth Meyer said about Michelle Wolf, for whom she used to work for him, that she uses every bit of the First Amendment. And even if you don't agree with what she says, the First Amendment says she gets to say it, particularly if it's humor or parody and in that arena. But there is a thing now, there is a rhetorical device where people feel that they can give it, but they don't have to take it. And Trump does this. I can insult whoever I want, however I want, but don't insult me back. So there's a lack of, the whole fairness aspect is missing.
Yeah, and we are talking about, if we take these three very disparate figures that we happen to sort of have teed up for today, Joy Reid, Michelle Wolf, and Kanye West, right? We've got two African-Americans, we've got two women. I mean, the remarks that Michelle Wolf made, Stanford Carpenter, I think probably would have been horribly unfunny had they been made by a man. Right. I mean, or would they have been horribly unfunny? Let me pose that interrogatively rather than as a statement.
I think quite a few of them would have been, but that's also part of humor. You know, part of being a good comedian is it's not just the words. It's your presentation is not just about your words. It's about you. It's about it's about claiming a space from which you can speak from. Which is going to be different depending on your identity and your subjectivity. It comes up in other areas of humor about there are certain words that some people can say. There are certain things that you can say about your close friends and family that you would have a problem with someone else saying. I think that's kind of built into our culture and our human interactions, and I think it also influences comedy. And I think that part of what made it entertaining was to actually have comedy go in some of those directions. Like, and it was able to go in that direction because it was coming from Michelle Wolf.
That's really interesting because Stanford just introduced in-group, out-group humor, that there's certain things that a woman can say about parts of their body, which she did, that she can say, she has license to say.
Right.
But she also used gender in a different way, and you were suggesting, when you think about what brings about a humor response, surprise is one of the things that does it. And some of the things coming out of not only her female mouth, but she looks a certain way. She's petite. She's, you know, she's kind of pretty in a Hollywood kind of way. And to have her open her mouth and say those things, which, you know, if Dave Chappelle said it, would be unsurprising.
Right. And she made fun of her own body.
Yes, she did.
Yeah.
She did.
Mean, Politico wrote a op-ed that said, mean isn't funny. It's one thing to make fun of people's political positions, but don't make fun of the person. And I thought the White House Correspondents' Dinner is the comedic routines at the Correspondents' Dinner for years now have done just that. They've made fun of people. I mean, there are people who credit Trump's desire to run for president to Obama's remarks about him at the White House Correspondents' Dinner. I don't know if I buy that theory.
And Seth Meyers.
And Seth Meyers. So, I mean, it's just like, what's the line? How do you know the line between mean and funny?
Trump does mean and funny all the time. Whether you agree with him or not, you see him using that rhetorical device.
We got to take a break. We will come back in just a bit. We'll have more of Midday Culture Connections with Dr. Sherry Parks and Dr. Stanford Carpenter. Our phone number here, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. You can find us on Twitter @MiddayWIPR, and you can follow us on the WIPR Facebook page. We'll take your calls when we come back. Stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Midday, and we are grateful to you for that. We want to welcome you back to this edition of Midday Culture Connections with Dr. Sherry Parks. She's about to become the Maryland Institute College of Art's new Vice President for Strategic Initiatives. That starts on the 1st of June. And Dr. Stanford Carpenter joins us as well. He's based in Chicago. He's here with us in Studio A. He's a cultural anthropologist, a comic book creator, and a political consultant, among other things. You are welcome to join our conversation about Joy Reid, Michelle Wolf, Kanye West. We're about to take him up in a second. 410-662-8780, our email, midday@wipr.org. We are on the WIPR Facebook page, streaming live, and you can find us on Twitter @MiddayWIPR. Flo sends us an email. Oh, thank you for clarifying Wolf's comment on Miss Sanders. I thought that Wolf said she burns her fat, F-A-T, and collects the ashes, and I was offended. But now I understand that Wolf said facts, F-A-C-T-S, and I'm totally with the comedian. And Flo, I feel you, because Sunday morning I was at a brunch, and the only thing I had seen about this, I hadn't seen the tape, I hadn't done anything other than I had seen a couple of tweets from people who said she made fun of Sarah Huckabee Sanders' appearance, and they mention her weight as well in these tweets, right? Now, I did a terrible thing for a journalist. I didn't track it down, and I started mouthing off about it at the brunch saying I thought it was terrible. Miss Wolf should have a better comedic imagination to be able to tell jokes without making fun of somebody's weight. And I guess I had not checked it out. Right. So, Flo, you and I both do, I think, what a lot of people do. They jump to some conclusions based on stuff that isn't true. Happens all the time.
I hadn't thought about that as a way of hearing that, because she immediately says she lies after that. She makes it clear that what she's talking about.
Because I hadn't actually heard her. I was responding to what I had heard about her, which is another, you know, that's a pit that we can all jump in from time to time. You know?
Well, the commentary that I listened to was really, I had a very different view of the commentary that I heard after I got a chance to watch her full, her full routine. And I think that's one of the other things that's really interesting about this. A lot of people are responding to the snippets. They're not looking at the full routine. The snippets all focus on the things that she said about Republicans. But if you look at her full routine, she went after Democrats. She basically called journalism a failed project.
Endangered species. For newspapers.
Endangered species. Yeah.
Certainly.
Mm-hmm. So.
And I agree with her that the most burning thing she said was right at the end about the media. She said, "You are profiting off of Donald Trump, and you made him." And that doesn't get as much coverage as
that's a critique that people have done in particular about CNN, giving him all that free airtime during the campaign because he attracted eyeballs. And that's what CNN's in the business of doing. Let's go to Stephen. Let's take one call. We'll come back to you after we talk to Stephen in Timonium. Welcome to Midday with Stanford Carpenter and Sherry Parks.
Hi. On the subject of Michelle Wolf, I just wanted to comment that, you know, what she said was fine and all, but I feel like the biggest criticism I had of her was something that was missing, and that at a roast, you're not just criticizing the person that you're roasting or the subject that you're roasting, but there's also got to be something uplifting, and that might be a little hard to find at the time that we're in, but, you know, you walk away from watching that, and to me, I just, you know, you don't feel uplifted, and I can understand where a lot of the criticism is coming from.
What do you think, Stanford? Is uplift an obligation of a comedy
no.
act?
I don't believe so. I can see the argument that uplift might be something that's important to the space that the comedy act is taking place in, but to the as far as the comedian herself, I don't think that she necessarily had that obligation. What struck me was the very last line that she said as she was walking off after the press, talking about them propping up for Trump. Her last line was, "And there's still not water in Flint, Michigan."
Yeah, mm-hmm. She was making a political statement
yeah.
there.
Yeah, and that wasn't funny. She didn't do that to be funny.
Right.
But I think there is, and I begin to see this more and more often, this narrative swoop that you see in public media of a happy ending at the end or an uplift at the end. And it's almost, and you see it even in evening news, that they'll tell you all of the awful things that are going on in the world, and then they show you puppies.
Right.
And so I think...
The latest funny YouTube video.
I think this is a growing trend of but it's okay because, you know, we have puppies.
Yeah. We're covering the good news, too, not just
in the arc of the story, I think increasingly we're getting that, which I actually think is a little scary because here's all of this awful thing that maybe we should do something about, whatever it is, but we don't have to because we still have puppies.
Of course, there's the whole notion of, you know, can somebody take a joke? So there are people saying, you know, the people on the right, Mr. Huckabee, who's obviously going to defend his daughter. I mean, I do the same thing.
Obviously, you know, on the workplace, would you defend your daughter at her work?
Yeah, I mean, if somebody made a shot that I thought was unfair, I would jump to her defense.
Absolutely. I would not want the men in my family to jump to my defense.
I was going to say, do you think she would appreciate it?
Well, I don't know if she'd appreciate it or not, but I can understand the instinct to defend your daughter. I mean, Mr. Huckabee is a TV person, and his daughter is a TV person. So in that instance, that makes sense to me that he would defend her. Would I do it? You know, my daughter's not a public person. She's a playwright. So and she's public to the extent that her work is out there. But I can see how, you know, you're right that she probably would blanch at the notion that daddy coming to my defense. But
because she's seen as weaker once daddy does that.
Well, maybe. And she doesn't need me to defend her. Believe me, she does a perfectly good job of it herself.
I've already had that moment where my daughter told me to stay away. No, I mean, no.
And it was humbling.
And she's how old?
She's 12. She's 12? And no, yeah. something happened, and my first instinct was to get involved, and we talked about it, and she was like, "No, Daddy, I really think I need to handle this myself."
Let's go back to the phones to Sean. Welcome to Midday. Thanks for your call.
Hello, how you doing?
Good.
I just had two quick comments. One, I found it funny, but I think it was hypocritical that those on the right always call people on the left snowflakes and can't take a joke, and yet they're complaining about, you know, what Michelle Wolf said. And also, if you read Sarah's father's tweet, he's talking about bullying, but yet he's mentioning that Michelle Wolf needs to eat a Tide Pod. So I just found it hypocritical. He's somewhat telling her to go kill herself. And that's it. Thank you.
Yeah. There's no shortage of hypocrisy in some of these things.
Someone collected.
Thanks for the call, Sean.
I'm sorry.
Sorry.
Someone collected how many times Sarah herself has said, "But the president was kidding," and so there is a double standard at play here.
One person who wasn't kidding this week is Kanye West, who in a series of tweets basically proclaimed his appreciation and support for President Donald Trump, which Stanford, to say the least, is not a widely held view among many of his fans, evidently.
True. My first thought is, why are we surprised? I go back to what thrust him onto the national stage, which was the comment about, you know, George Bush hating black people. And in that moment, you know, although I was not a fan of the administration, I did have a problem with that statement. I thought it was kind of over-encompassing. I thought it came across as sort of juvenile and petulant.
It jumping on the stage with Taylor Swift and
yeah, and I was going to go into that too, right? You know, and I think that that put him on the stage being provocative, and being provocative in a way that shows almost a lack of real depth of thought in terms of what it's going to mean to say something, you know, in those particular words. And that's been sort of the highlight of his career since. And many people say, oh, since his mom died, he hasn't been the same. I'm like, no, he's kind of been the same. It's just that what's happened is he's run out of things that he can do that are provocative in terms of his fan base, that this fan base are going to agree with. And now he's switching to stuff that his fan base isn't going to agree with. You know, once you kind of go down that road of feeling like your existence depends on being provocative, you end up there.
There's no more space on the left. So
yeah, exactly.
Well, there's this assumption that people in Hollywood, people in show business are all on the left. I mean, we see that Roseanne Barr and Kanye West have proven that that's not necessarily the case.
Well, but Roseanne Barr, if you actually look at the show, I mean, there actually is a diversity of opinions on the show. So I think we tend to push.
But
people.
She herself, yes, evidently, she herself. Has come yes, out not yes. as the character, yes, but right. as her own person. Are there parallels between those two? What do you think?
Between Kanye and
Roseanne.
I think Roseanne sincerely believes, or at least she's been consistent about her support for Trump. With Kanye, you also have to question whether or not this is opportunism. And I'm going to move away from Kanye to a columnist who was local, who was a conservative columnist, and we were on a panel together. And I could tell up front that he didn't quite believe what he was saying, so I went behind the scenes and said, what is this? And he said, I'm a mediocre journalist. Do you think I'd be on this panel if I were not a conservative? And so one way to remember, go back to what we said.
So it was his act.
It was his act. And it is surprising to be a black person who is supporting Trump. And therefore, you can get attention, like, you know, like the black guy who stands behind Trump with the shirt, you know, proclaiming his blackness and his love for Trump. You get attention when you go to the right if you're black.
Candace Owens, who is an activist and a pro-Trump internet star, who believes that black people have been brainwashed by the media to vote for Democrats. And anybody who comes to the support of Ms. Owens, who is a pro-Trump blogger and podcaster, runs into some opposition.
Well, I mean, this whole thing about you know, being sort of in the thrall of the Democratic Party, it's a much more complicated relationship, and some of these voting choices are not as simple, right? It's not just about voting between the lesser of two evils. I mean, I think that you've got black people who are stuck in a situation where they feel like we can vote for a Democratic Party that doesn't necessarily look out for us the way we'd like them to. Or who doesn't care about us versus a Republican Party that's actively trying to do us harm.
And Dr. Carpenter, we're going to have to make that the last word. I appreciate your being here. And Sherry Parks, as always, good to see you. We'll see you next time. Appreciate it. Dr. Stanford Carpenter is a cultural anthropologist, a comic book creator, and a political consultant. He serves on the board of the Black Comic Arts Festival and Pocket Con. That's a convention that focuses on comics for young boys and girls of color. Dr. Sherry Parks is about to conclude her tenure at the University of Maryland College Park. On June 1st, she will become the vice president for strategic initiatives at the Maryland Institute College of Art. That's it for us today. Tomorrow on Midday, it's Midday at the Movies. Jed Dietz is the founding director of the Maryland Film Festival. That opens tomorrow night. We'll have a preview with Jed and the actor Jim Belushi, the director Matt Porterfield, and Joe Trapea and Eric Leung. All three of those guys are directors of movies that are in or have been at the festival. Cinematographer Bradford Young is going to join me. He's the first African-American to be nominated for an Academy Award for cinematography. We'll talk about the 20th annual Maryland Film Festival tomorrow on Midday. Thanks to Joe Squared for providing lunch today. Joe Squared serves coal-fired pizzas, risotto, and local craft beers. Location and hours at joesquared.com. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great day.